Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program today. One natural approach to helping with infections. Now, think of all the killing bacteria that are out there, like the MRSA. Tens of thousands of Americans die each year because the antibiotics, the most powerful we have, are not enough. So what do we do? Well, I'll give you an idea what you can do to help with candida and other infections. Then we're going to also talk about curcumin and the cuminoids, the active ingredient, and what they do that's new and important that can help us and prevent disease. Also talk about how to get rid of those amyloid plaques in the brain, especially with dementia, forgetfulness, and even Alzheimer's. New peer-reviewed literature on that. Always the latest on health and healing to begin our program. Then from our environmental segment today, I'm going to go into greater depth as to why we have to be concerned about water. When I travel around the United States, as I do all the time, I'm finding people in areas that should be extremely concerned are completely oblivious. Now, these are not people with the without a capacity to understand the issue. They simply are in denial. So today, comments from Michael Snyder on reasons a global water crisis is approaching. I'll add my own comments in because I'm doing a new book on our environment, and I have a lot of new information on how long do you have before water runs out where you live. No one has shared this with you before. I think it's very important that you pay attention to this. Then following up on that, even more on our environment today, a lot of people came to Washington and protested, about 30 to 45,000. The Keystone Pipeline. Bill McKibben was the person that put it all together along with other individuals, but it came and went with nothing happening. I believe that their efforts are misplaced. I believe that there's far more you could do than just show up at a rally when you know that the people are not going to pay attention to you. They still are giving credit to this president of making the right choice. He has made the right choice consistently. I know of no president in my lifetime that has been more absolutely perfect in the choices he's made for those that he sides with. They just don't happen to be the constituents that voted him into office. The working middle class, the upper middle class, professional class, the poor. It's all about the rich and powerful. Here's one more thing that was predictable. A new report shows that the State Department's Keystone report that the president is going to review and from that make his decision, it was actually written by a Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline dirty tar sand contractor. You can't make this stuff up. So needless to say, he's going to give a report that shows there's no problem, and the president will then say it's in the best interest, and this is how it always happens. So I'll deal with that. My guest in the second part of our program is an exclusive. This is the only place in the United States you will hear this. We are going to prove today on this radio program that from the White House and the Defense Department and the Pentagon, we in the United States created and promoted death squads and torture centers in Iraq. We will prove this, something no one else has been able to do. The person behind this is Maggie O'Kane, and she is a multi-award-winning investigative journalist and head of investigative documentaries for The Guardian. And she is a Emmy award-winning filmmaker, and she was the British Journalist of the Year, and she was also Foreign Correspondent of the Year when she worked as a journalist for The Guardian. We have some really powerful information. And then I will immediately have you go to a website so you can watch this short documentary for yourself. It is powerful. But we have the exclusive story. I don't know how much more time we will have. If we have any other time, I'll give you just a couple of examples of the massive waste that our bureaucracies engage in. And one will be from Peter Van Buren from TomDispatch.com talking about what happens when you end up doing the wrong thing. And clearly they have done the wrong thing in Iraq. He'll give you just one example of how we built something that was never used, but all those photo ops and all those news stories about how we're helping the Iraqi people get back on their feet, it was all a sham, a fraud, a complete, total fraud. And I'll give you the details on it. And that's only one of thousands of examples. Mission unaccomplished. Why the invasion of Iraq was the single worst foreign policy decision in American history. From Peter Van Buren. Let us begin. Infections, they're everywhere, all the time. What is the issue? The issue is most people's bodies are weakened, their immune systems are down, which makes it much easier for them to become infected. What can we do about it? Well, you can take antibiotics, and most people do. But what happens when those antibiotics don't work? And in many cases, with the MRSA and other antibiotic-resistant drugs, you can die. And tens of thousands of Americans die each year. So what can you take that can help with these infections, topically or internally? Well, allicin, A-L-L-I-C-I-N, that's garlic. That's the active ingredient in garlic. Chinese skullcap. Believe it or not, banana peel. There's an extract within the peel that is extremely powerful because it kills bacteria of all types. Bay leaves. One of the best, I mentioned it yesterday, it's used everywhere in the South, bee propolis. Now, bee propolis looks like a little tar. It's very bitter, and it's a thick resin. And it's what the bees line the hives with, which acts as a natural antibiotic for the bees. And if anyone was coming down with a cold or the flu or some congestion where I grew up, your grandmother would take a little pinch of bee propolis, some raw honey, stirred around in a cup of tea, and you drink that down. It works. Then you have probiotics. Catechins, those are found in green teas, catnip, cinnamon oil, cloves, clove oil, cumin, black cumin seed oil. You can also get elecampane, E-L-E-C-A-M-P-A-N-E, eucalyptus, grapeseed extract, grapefruit extract, raw honey, lavender, lemongrass, mangosteen. Also important would be the Norway spruce, olive leaf extract, peppermint and peppermint oil, prickly ash, sage, sandalwood, colloidal silver, tea tree oil, and thyme. All of those have good quality science behind them showing their natural antibiotic activity, their antimicrobial and antiparasitic bacteria. Some have antiviral activity. So at least now you have a list of things that could help you when you need help. Next up is that rich, dark chocolate that we all like and that's good for us. Here's the newest research in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. They analyzed how the epicatechin, the main flavanol in cocoa, which is rich, can impact insulin levels. And here's what it says, quote, our data suggests that epicatechin and cocoa phenolic extract strengthens the insulin signaling by activating key proteins of that pathway and regulating glucose production through activated protein kinase and modulation of HEP G2 cells, end quote. Now, that's just a scientific statement. I'm reading directly from the peer-reviewed journal. What does that mean in just lay language? Here's what it means. When you have a piece of chocolate, preferably deep, healthy, organic chocolate, there are chemicals in it called polyphenols. And the polyphenols contain specific extracts called epicatechin. And they, in turn, can help modulate your insulin levels, and that helps you if you're diabetic. Hence, the takeaway line, diets rich in cocoa can help people with diabetes to regulate insulin levels, and that's very important. And also, curcumin. It has over 1,000 articles in the peer-reviewed literature on what it does. The latest comes from research from oncologists working at Johns Hopkins University. And what they found was that curcumin impacts cancer. Quote, here's what it says. A Dr. Sukumar's passion for turmeric is partially rooted in the fact that the spice has long been a staple in traditional Indian cuisine, which is a significant part of her rich heritage. Dr. Sukumar has also been studying the unique compositional profile of turmeric, and specifically curcumin, for many years now, which led her to some fascinating discoveries about its vast potential for use in medicine. Besides quelling inflammation and pain and promoting wound healing, turmeric is a seemingly miraculous anti-cancer nutrient of the highest order. Quote, we have close to 300 publications that cite turmeric for its anti-cancer effects. Many diseases, such as colon cancer and other types of cancer, are being traced to inflammation, and hence the need for this. Now, the inflammation linked to cancer is backed by a lot of scientific studies, including a major review in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which found that up 25% of all cancers are caused by chronic inflammation. And then according to scientists from Ohio State University's Comprehensive Cancer Center, inflammation triggers an increase in a molecule known as microRNA 155 that causes a reduction in the levels of the protein responsible for repairing damaged DNA. So when you take curcumin, one of the most powerful and promising, quote, preventative chemo and anti-cancer agents, and epidemiological evidence demonstrates that people who incorporate high doses of curcumin in their diets have a lower incidence of cancer, end quote. So that's one more reason to take your curcumin every day. Oh, and for those of you who believe that your cell phone's not a problem, this is from David Goldkin and Lothar Moer, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, and the Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, and the National Academy of Sciences. Quote, a method is described for measuring absorbed electromagnetic energy radiated from cell phone antenna into via brain tissue. And it talks about how this is done and the absorbency rate and how it converts into a Joule heat and affects the nuclear magnetic shielding of the Lamor precession. In lay language, when you're holding that cell phone up to your head, when you're in front of electromagnetic pulsating any form of equipment, that is causing your brain to heat up. That's bad, and now they have an easier way of measuring it. Not good. And finally, in a major study on the impact of vitamin D3 and DHA that you find in omega-3 fatty acids, they help clear amyloid plaques found in Alzheimer's disease. Quote, a pilot study involving serum samples from both Alzheimer's tissue patients and healthy controls identified and clarified mechanisms underlying active forms of vitamin D3 and DHA, which may regulate immune activities and help to clear amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's disease. And then it goes on to talk about the science of it. So that's good news. Keep taking your vitamin D3 and keep taking your omega-3 fatty acids. The research was done at the David Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Continuing with our examination of fascism in America, I believe that the United States, most of the American public, and certainly the majority of its political and economic leaders have engaged in a Faustian deal with the devil of war. Sam Sachs of Truth Out, and many of us, believe that we must examine what is happening. I believe this is almost imperceptible. Each week, each month, each year, more and more of our rights are taken away. For those of us who value the Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our capacity to live in harmony, we are being threatened. The United States made a deal long ago that has sealed our nation's fate today. German folklore tells a story of a man named Faust, who, bored with his life as a scholar and seeking unlimited knowledge and power and pleasure, makes a deal with the devil to attain all these things. In return, however, Faust agrees to give the devil his soul at the end of 24 years. This is where the term a Faustian bargain comes from, and it refers to someone willing to sacrifice their moral integrity just to attain power and pleasure for a limited time. Today, the United States is the most powerful and wealthiest nation on the planet. No other nation even comes close in terms of military power. The United States spends more on so-called defense than the next 70 nations combined. And when it comes to our supposed biggest threat in the future, the Chinese, we spend 600% more on our military than they do. And in terms of wealth, the United States' gross domestic product is about $15.5 trillion. That's about three times the gross domestic product of China, the second wealthiest nation on the planet. Unfortunately, just like Faust, all of this power and wealth did not come honestly. It came as a result of a bargain with the devil of war. Out of the chaos of World War II, it was the United States that trumped everyone and embarked on an empire building for the remainder of the 21st century. And despite seeing the dangers of hyper-militarism in Japan and Germany, the United States would go on to make the very same mistakes, relying on never-ending war to expand its influence and wealth and power on the planet. It was none other than the father of the Constitution himself, James Madison, who warned early in the infancy of this nation that no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. But as soon as World War II, the supposed war to end all wars, ended, the United States got involved in the never-ending warfare game. The drop-off in military spending after Japan surrendered was immediately replaced by Presidents Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, who both triggered a massive expansion of war spending that included overt war spending in Korea and covert war spending all around the world to destabilize any government that was not on our side and to contain what they called the Soviet aggression. To ensure that global capitalism reigned supreme, to enrich the oligarchical class of bankers and corporate executives and oil barons, our military intervened all around the world throughout the 1950s, meddling in Iran, Guatemala, Indonesia, and Cuba. President Eisenhower knew the consequences of the Faustian bargain with the devil of war. Quote, he said in 1953, under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. In that same cross of iron speech, Eisenhower explained how increased war spending eats away at a nation from within. Quote, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is the electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single fighter with a half a million bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have been housing 8,000 people, end quote. This was during a time when our nation was spending roughly $50 billion a year on defense. Now we're spending $1.4 trillion. Despite his own warnings, Eisenhower did little to renegotiate the terms of this morally repugnant deal, and by the start of the 1960s, he knew something had gone terribly wrong. In his 1961 farewell address, Eisenhower warned, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex, he noted. The potential for the disastrous rise in misplaced power exists and will persist. In a moment, I will play you his actual talk. But our lawmakers didn't listen to Eisenhower. The Vietnam War, plus more covert wars in South America, Asia, and the Middle East, to ensure that global capitalists in the United States had favorable regimes to do business with around the world, would ramp up our military budget through the 1960s and 70s, taking the Pentagon annual spending to nearly $200 billion. During the 1980s, spending on war would grow exponentially with more covert operations across the globe and high-tech missile defense boondoggles like Star Wars. During his two terms in the White House, Reagan would increase annual military spending from less than $200 billion to nearly $400 billion. At the same time, Reagan slashed taxes and cut spending to social programs. Now, although the Soviet Union fell and defense spending leveled off in the 1990s, the perpetual war machine continued to grind on. There was Desert Storm in Iraq, military invasion in Kosovo, airstrikes in the Sudan, another bombing raid on Iraq to close out the decade. And then George Bush moved to the White House. 9/11 happened, and military spending went through the roof. Two new wars were started, and a brand new covert drone warfare program was unleashed across the planet. Our defense budget tripled under Bush and then under Obama. We now spend between $900 billion and $1.5 trillion a year to maintain this deal with the devil. On every corner of the planet, we have between 900 to 1,100 military bases of all sizes and purposes. They include massive installments like Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and small secret facilities in Africa used primarily to launch drones. And almost every single dollar that you and I and everyone else in this country pay in income taxes goes in supporting this massive military empire. Our defense war spending eats up 94% of all federal income tax revenue. And in return, the billionaire class has profited immensely with oil and shipping lanes wide open and favorable business deals in foreign markets. But within the United States, it is rotting. This Faustian deal is sunsetting. We learned last week that the American economy contracted by 0.1% in the fourth quarter, despite the fact that overall consumption in the economy grew by 2.2%. The reason why the economy shrank was because the war budget shrank by 22% last month. In other words, when missiles, tanks, and warplanes aren't being manufactured, our economy runs into trouble. As President Obama said in his Super Bowl interview with CBS on Sunday, quote, "The economy shrank a little bit despite the fact that housing is recovering, manufacturing is going strong, car sales are up. The big problem was defense spending cuts of 22%, end quote. With so much of our economy dependent upon perpetual war, we officially have a war economy, which means we must continue this endless war or suffer further economic ruin beyond what we're already experiencing with rampant joblessness, declining wages, and spiraling budget deficits on a local, state, and federal level. But drive around Washington, D.C., in the suburbs in Virginia, and you'll see enormous palaces built in gated communities where the war profiteers reside. In 2002, the five largest war profiteering corporations saw $2.4 billion in profits, but last year grew to almost $14 billion. They're the real winners in this Faustian bargain. And it's difficult to rectify this wealth across the Potomac with the desperation across America. For the hundreds of billions we spend every year on them and their wars, we could be sending an entire generation to college for free. We could bring financial security to 50 million Americans living in poverty by giving them a real living wage. We could establish a single-payer health care system to finally put an end to the carnage of 40,000 Americans who die every year in America because they don't have health insurance. As economic hardships for the vast majority of us intensifies, then this deal with the United States, made with the devil of war, creeps closer to its due date. We've acquired our enormous wealth and power for the few, but the day we must understand is we are a nation with a sick soul. Do we really want to be a devilish empire that brings carnage to the rest of the world while our own population at home suffers? We know how this story ends. It ends in collapse. It always has throughout all of history. That's why we must renege on this deal. We must take on the military-industrial complex and rethink empire. It will be a painful journey fraught with danger and likely accompanied by economic pain, but it's the only way to save our national soul. Back in a moment, please stay with us.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows.
We'll go to our guest, everyone, in just a moment. She is in London, England, and Maggie O'Kane, who I gave you her background, will call her right now, but let me add something from Norman Solomon from nationofchange.org. He writes, "Congress, end endless war and stop becoming the evil that we deplore." This is short, but important. Congress waited 6 years to repeal the Tonkin Gulf Resolution after it opened the bloody floodgates for the Vietnam War in August of 1964. If that seems slow, consider the continuing failure of Congress to repeal the War on Terror resolution, the authorization for use of military force that sailed through with just one dissenting vote 3 days after 9/11. Prior to casting the only no vote, Congresswoman Barbara Lee spoke on the House floor. As we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore, she said. But we have. That's why more than 11 years later, Lee's prophetic one-minute speech is so painful to watch. The war on terror has inflicted carnage in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere as a matter of routine. Targets change, but the assumed prerogative to kill with impunity remains. Now, Representative Lee has introduced H.R. 198, a measure to repeal the authorization for use of military force. I think it's very important. Opposed to repeal, the Obama administration is pleased to keep claiming that the 137-month-old resolution justifies everything from on-the-ground troops to combat to drone strikes and kill lists to flagrant abrogation of civil liberties. A steep uphill incline faces efforts to repeal the resolution that issued a blank political check for war in the early fall of 2001. Struggling to revoke it is a valuable undertaking. Yet even repeal would be unlikely to end the war on terror. At the start of 1971, President Nixon felt compelled to sign a bill that included a repeal of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. By then, he had shifted his ostensible authority for continuing the war in Vietnam, asserting his prerogative as commander-in-chief. Leaders of the warfare state never lack for rationales when they want to keep making war. In retrospect, the United States' war on terror has turned out to be even more tenacious than the U.S. war that took several million lives in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia during the 1960s and early 70s. Some key similarities resonate with current circumstances. Year after year, in Congress, support for the Vietnam War was bipartisan. Presidents Johnson and Nixon preached against unauthorized violence in America's cities while inflicting massive violence in southeastern Asia. Both presidents were fond of proclaiming fervent wishes for peace. But unlike the horrific war in Southeast Asia, the ongoing and open-ended war on terror is not confined by geography or apparently by calendar. The search for enemies to smite and create is availing itself of a bottomless pit, while bottom-feeding military contractors keep making a killing. And beyond the worthy goal of repealing the authorization for use of military force is a need for Congress to cut off appropriations for the war on terror, a prerequisite repudiating the lethal mythology of righteous war unbounded by national borders or conceivable duration. What may even be more difficult to rescind is the chronic disconnect between lofty oratory and policies digging the country deeper into endless war. Repealing the authorization for use of military force will be very hard, but it's doable. And that's from Norman Solomon. I have my guest on hold. Let us say hello to Maggie O'Kane. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, thank you.
Last evening I watched your film, and first I want to commend you on a job well done. For the people in this audience, the film America's Mystery Man in Iraq can be accessed at guardian.co.uk. Now, after watching it, here is my overarching concern. Virtually all the president's men, George Bush and Dick Cheney, the vice president, and Rumsfeld, the Department of Defense's secretary, and all the leading generals and Joint Chiefs of Staff commanders, and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, all have stated that we are against torture, we do not assassinate people, we engage in a moral war. And then Obama has said the same. And before him, it was Bill Clinton. And yet, when you speak with many of the vets, as I have, and I've done four documentaries on the veterans who've come back from our wars, they give you a different story of what actually happens. So I was heartened by the truth finally coming out. In some of the interviews, you describe this man named Steele, and who was very close. Colonel Steele was very close to all the power in the defense secretary, also General Petraeus. And we know that this man, Steele, had started his craft of warfare in Vietnam, then was moved in 1984 to El Salvador, to train paramilitaries that became death squads to eradicate guerrillas, which left 75,000 dead and 1 million people forced to leave their homes. And General Petraeus studied Steele's methods in El Salvador and was impressed and later used Steele in Iraq to train police forces. And by the time of the Iraq War, Steele was a civilian, forced to leave after lying to a congressional committee about his involvement with Oliver North's Nicaragua gunrunning. And he was brought into Iraq to work with the Energy Board, but was fully involved in clandestine paramilitary training. So if you would pick it up from there, please, and talk about who this man, Colonel Steele, really was, what you learned about him, the power he had, from the different people that you interviewed who worked directly with him, and his association with Rumsfeld and others. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Yeah, it's taken a long time. It's taken 15 months. And the first thing I want to say as an Irish journalist working in England, that none of this would have happened without the WikiLeaks documents and with Bradley Manning, basically, because what happened was we just became very curious about this strange order, which I don't know if you remember, it's called Fragmentary Order 242, which was a military order ordering serving U.S. soldiers not to take any further action if they came across torture. So the thing that came into our mind was, you know, why was it necessary to issue that order? Why was it scattered throughout the WikiLeaks? And so we began a process of trying to understand who these special police commanders were exactly. And one of the battles you have in all of this is to battle through the language, and the language of war is so extraordinarily desensitized in a way, because we talk about counterinsurgency. So the special police commanders were a group that was set up by initially by the Iraqis themselves, very briefly, for a period of about 1 or 2 weeks. They had taken an initiative with some very tough fighters to fight the insurgency. This initiative was recognized by Colonel Steele, who had experience of working with police forces in El Salvador and in Panama, as something that they wanted to support. They then introduced this initiative to Petraeus. And there began a story which over 18 months meant that the special police commanders, without any checking on how they were operating, received millions of dollars of American taxpayers' money to set up what turned out to be a network of, we believe, 13 detention torture centers throughout the country, mainly in areas where there was the insurgency against the Americans was strongest. And we believe, from our 15 months of investigation, from talking to Iraqis, from talking to American soldiers, to talking with the actual generals who worked with the American advisors in the detention centers, that thousands of Iraqis, mainly Sunnis, were tortured in these centers as a way of extracting information on the insurgency. And that information was then, that the high-value detainees were lifted, partly because lists were issued by the Americans, mainly by Steele, to pick these people up. And they were picked up in joint American-Iraqi raids on homes. And, you know, for example, on the 27th of May 2004, there was a raid in which over 500 Sunni men and boys were picked up. Many of them were tortured. In the end, 45 were detained. But for weeks, these men were held. So you had a kind of wide-scale sweep of, and a sort of, I don't want to use the word industrialized because it's overstating it, but certainly an organized structure which involved torture, which was overseen by the American advisors, retired Colonel Steele, and also was overseen by Colonel James Kaufman, who was General David Petraeus' special advisor to the special police commandos. And General Colonel Kaufman describes himself in the Stars and Stripes, in an interview in the Stars and Stripes, as General Petraeus' eyes and ears on the ground. Now, these two men were in these detention centers, moved between them, and we also have spoken to people who say that they were there while torture was clearly taking place. However, we have no evidence that they actually tortured prisoners themselves.
Well, that would not really be my interest. That would be like a guard who is the person who says, ready, aim, fire, and you have 12 people shooting someone who's got a blindfold on. If you're the one who's there,
yes.
I don't see the difference of who actually did the beating. You describe in your film that there's a table in a room and that there was blood dripping off the table. And people were screaming until Colonel Steele went into the room, and then they stopped screaming because he was trying to have a conversation and couldn't have a conversation. It doesn't matter who is doing the beating to the man who is bleeding. It's the fact that he's the one who's giving the orders. He is the go-to person. Would you say that's accurate in these interrogations of overseeing these centers?
Well, I don't know that he said, right, go into the room now and pull out this guy's toenails. I mean, we don't have that kind of an account. What we have is accounts. And there's two accounts that you mentioned. The first is an account which this is the extraordinary thing about this war. Initially came out in a New York Times magazine article in 2005 in which the journalist Peter Mass and Gilles Perez, who's a Magnum photographer, went to Samarra and came across Steele. And Mass gives this account, which he later gave to us, of being asked, interviewing Steele. And the screams from next door of somebody screaming, Allah, Allah, were so loud that Steele said, excuse me, I stopped the interview, left the room, and while he was away, the screaming stopped, and he came back in, and he didn't say anything. He sat down. And I think what was really interesting about Samarra, it's about this. This was a library. This is the library in the city that was set up by the Americans and the special police commanders for the purposes of torture. Now, the interesting thing about this deniability is that you had a situation where the ordinary decent soldiers, and there were many of them who reported this, were discouraged from actually giving any more details about what was happening. It was as though everyone was distancing themselves from what happened, and that the special police commandos and the most brutish of their torturers, and they used interrogation committees which were set up, which were consisted of 8 men, in each of these centres, and people were tortured, were interrogated for between 3 and 5 days, those that were of high value. And then when they had finished with them, they would cast them off. Colonel Steele would indicate which ones he was interested in, and then he would make a call and they would be picked up and taken to the American base at the airport. We have not investigated what happened to those men when they went there. I have no information on that. And neither do the Iraqi people who gave us the accounts of what was happening.
One of the parts of the film that was very dramatic was when some very conscientious soldiers working in Iraq saw a group of people being tortured, overtly tortured. They physically intervened to stop the torture. They also took a series of photographs, which are in your film, where you see the massive bruises and bashed heads and knocked skin that is lacerated. Clearly, nothing that would be acceptable by any standard of interrogation. And then they reported this, and then they got a call from a commander telling him to step down. And then they were told when they got back to their base, this didn't happen. You didn't see anything. Forget this. Is that correct?
Yeah. This was an account by the Oregonian soldiers, a number of from an unit from Oregon, where on the 29th of June in Baghdad, when they visited a site at Nisour Square, and while they were there, one of their scouts had said, look, they're torturing people down there, and he was looking at them through the sights from a higher building. So these soldiers were horrified by what was going on, and they went into the building. They raided the place, and what they described is the kind of complacency of the Iraqi special commanders who were there, who kind of sort of smiled and said, look, guys, this isn't your scene, this is our scene. And then they made a call to say that they were going to arrest these commandos, and they were told to withdraw, to step back from the building. And one of the soldiers had actually had to be forcibly pulled away. He was so deeply distressed by what was going on. And then they did return to base, where they were spoken to by their commander, and he said, this should go no further. You haven't seen this. So One of the soldiers then did take it further and actually went to the press and spoke about what has happened, and it led to a investigation by the military, in which they were finally all exonerated and were commended for having spoken the truth. But, you know, the extraordinary thing about that is that it was very rare that any soldiers in the climate were prepared to say, look, this is happening, it shouldn't be going on. And I have to say, one of the things we found most difficult was to get... We Facebooked, we tweeted, we just tried everything through the social media to get hold of these young soldiers who we knew were there and were eyewitness to it. But actually, they were so terrified of actually giving an account of what they saw. And again, it's the sort of Bradley Manning thing. They were thinking, well, why should I speak? I might get into trouble. The fear was really interesting. And in the end, the only person who went on camera, and I think he's very impressive, is a soldier called Neil Smith, who lives in Detroit, who was 21 then. And he has subsequently, since he left the army, has volunteered to work with refugees from the Arab world, because he was so horrified about what was happening. He wanted to, in a way, make his peace, and he's also become a Christian, a born-again Christian. So somehow, wherever it came from, he felt that he wanted to speak out about what he'd seen. And it's a very important testimony, because it is an American soldier who's talking about what's happened.
I agree. Watching him, it's very compelling. We're always told, as we were with Abu Ghraib, that it didn't go up the ladder, that whatever problems existed were a few rotten apples at the bottom, and that's where it all ended. However, from documents that you showed, it is clear that Rumsfeld, at the very least, knew exactly what was going on, because Steele was telling him what was going on. And we know that Rumsfeld, Cheney, and George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, met every day, so they would have all known, because they sit around in these meetings and talk about all the different things that they're aware of. So review the press conference footage to Rumsfeld specifically denying knowledge of Steele's activities and death squad killings and the use of torture by Iraqi security, and then show us the proof that he lied.
Well, I mean, the thing is, we can only, in a way, build the facts as we have them. And the facts that we have them is that we know that Steele was sent into Iraq by Rumsfeld. The reason we know this is because he writes a memo, which is in his own archive, to George Bush, saying that introducing the figure of Steele and saying that we have sent this man into Iraq who is working with the special police commanders. Now, what I find interesting is he's very sparse in the details of, you know, what exactly Steele is there to do. And actually, I get the impression from reading the letter that Bush certainly didn't know who Steele was. However, we do know that Dick Cheney had appointed Steele. First of all, that Dick Cheney knew Steele from Iran-Contra, because Steele was actually running the airbase, the Ilopango airbase in Nicaragua, when they were flying arms into El Salvador. Sorry, in El Salvador, flying arms into Nicaragua. So, you know, he was one of the key members of North's troop. Now, Dick Cheney was on the congressional committee and brought out a separate report. He was unhappy with the findings of it. So Cheney had known Steele since 1989. Then Cheney brought him in to run the police force in Panama. So they were extremely close. Wolfowitz talks about Steele, about his record in Central America, and he is highly decorated. He is one of America's most highly decorated soldiers for his work in Vietnam. He clearly is a very brave man under fire, and has been involved in hostage releases. I don't think anyone could dispute that he's a brave soldier, but I think he was also the person who was supervising the counterinsurgency and the collection of human intelligence. And I think we need to get away from the euphemisms of all that, and that's torture. That is turning people on spits, that is holding people up until they dislocate their shoulders, that's pulling people's toenails out. That's what, and as I say, he didn't physically take part in that himself, but these were the techniques that were used.
What I was particularly galvanized about your film is it after watching this current film that was an Academy Award nominated film for Best Film on the capture of Osama bin Laden and showing the interrogation techniques, you know, smacking some people and waterboarding them, those are relatively mild compared to what is described in photographs shown in personal eyewitnesses of people who were tortured under the supervision of Americans, including Steele, by the Iraqi police squads, working with virtual impunity. And they were the first, as you showed, to get a hundred and some trucks to be mounted with guns. They got unlimited amounts of cash to spend around anywhere they wanted on what they needed. They had all these secret interrogation centers and, in effect, torture centers. And then you showed repeatedly throughout the results of this sectarian conflict between the Sunnis, that represent about 20% of the population, but at one time had been, through its Ba'athist party, ran, for all intents and purposes, ran under Saddam Hussein, who was a Ba'athist, and a Sunni, ran the government and had all the privileged positions. And you saw the sectarian violence that occurred once all this got into full motion. And you mentioned in the film 3,000 bodies were turning up on a monthly basis at that time. And I'm thinking, wow, this is, the American public hasn't seen this. The American public hasn't heard this. This takes our whole understanding of what was done, who did it, who oversaw it, who funded it, to a completely different level. Could you describe that, please?
Well, I think the torture is one thing, and I would like to sort of put some context in this. That, you know, the special police commanders, as well as torturing people for information, were also, you know, taking part in battles, you know, in Mosul, in Fallujah, places where there was, you know, real ongoing battles, and they were good soldiers. So as well as being torturers, they were also good soldiers, whatever, in this kind of skewed world we live in, we should acknowledge that, and that was seen as part of their value. But, I mean, I think the biggest tragedy of all this, and the reason why we really wanted to make this film, and this is like the 18th film we've made in Iraq, was because the as in El Salvador, and that's the tragedy, that when you choose your friends, and if you choose friends who are a sectarian group, which in this case, the special police commanders were almost entirely made up of Shias. Now, the Shias had a debt to settle with the Sunnis, which, you know, may have been sorted out in one way or another if things had been sorted out in Iraq. But, you know, basically, once they had, Rumsfeld and Bremer, had dismantled the Iraqi security system, taken out the police force, had basically made hundreds of thousands of men unemployed in a crazy strategy that caused a complete vacuum, then the people who flooded into the vacuum, with the help and assistance of the US administration, were sectarian groups, were Shia groups, and they turned on the Sunni population, who, you know, also had Al-Qaeda in with them. But, I mean, so you basically unleashed a sectarian civil war on the country that may not have happened. It certainly accelerated the pace of it. It certainly added to the brutality of it if you were to arming this force. And I think there's where the parallels are in El Salvador, when you think, you know, it was a population of 6 million people and 75,000 people died in that war. So, you know, the bigger picture is, you, by arming a sector of a community, going in there, you do destabilize the community, and it turns into a horrendous civil war with grave consequences for ordinary people.
Explain the June 2004 military order, Frago 242.
Well, Frago 242 stands for Fragmentary Order 242. And we're not exactly sure when it was issued. It could have been May or June 2004. But it was an order from the U.S. military command. Again, we don't know who signed it. It could possibly have been Petraeus. It may have been the other generals who were there at the time. But we don't know. But certainly it was a high-level military command which said no further action required, which meant and soldiers described it to us. If you walked into a detention centre and a man was being electrocuted in his testicles by a cranked-up military phone, you weren't required to do anything. If you walked into a detention centre, and that is one description that we had from an eyewitness, if you came across torture of any kind, then no further action was required. It was basically you can turn a blind eye to torture. And part of the reason that was issued is because American soldiers in their thousands were reporting up the line what was happening. I think the difficulty was they didn't realise that this ultimately was part of the strategy. So what you had is a sort of, well, no, I can't say that, but the feeling must be that what is the point in reporting this because no further action is required? And then the official order states that no further action is required. So that is what FAGO 242 is. It's an order by the American military high command to ignore torture.
So this puts the lie to everything that we've been told. And I'm asking our audience, the lawyers, the journalists, the people who listen, the academics, we should ask for a federal independent investigation for crimes against humanity. We've been lied to, and this is just but one part of the documentation that we should be examining. We're out of time. Thank you very much for coming on, Maggie O'Kane, and sharing this horrific film that needs to be seen by people and can be by going to guardian.co.uk. The title of the film is James Steele, America's Mystery Man in Iraq. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you very much for having me.
Maggie O'Kane, this was an exclusive interview. This is the first you've heard this in the United States in any medium. We're happy to present this to you on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you for listening. Now time for TalkBack. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. That's a powerful interview, and I didn't even have a chance to get into Petraeus controlling $2 billion for his operations. Did you know that? And how all those communiques between the people working directly with Petraeus and the Pentagon and Steele. And they all work together. In every picture, you see them all together in all those rooms in Iraq. They were the overseers. They were the implementers. And the Iraqis, the Sunni Iraqis, did this. And even an interesting meeting they had with former Iraq Minister of the Interior, Al-Samar, who lived in exile, gave some really powerful insights. And a lot of generals, Iraqi generals, Shia generals, gave some powerful testimony about what was going on and how this happened. All this has been kept secret. Now it's not. Let's say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. We'll talk about things that people don't want to explore and know about. I've gotten several emails from your audience members about Valerie Harper, the actress from Mary Tyler Moore, who was diagnosed with a rare brain cancer that seems to be a possible extension of a lung cancer. and basically, they handed her a sentence, if you will, saying, you got X amount of days to live. We can't give you chemo because it doesn't reach up. This type of cancer is between the meninges of the brain. And basically, they told her it's untreatable and you're terminal. So now she's on all the talk shows telling everyone how she's going to spend the end of her days. And
Why don't people reach out to her? Because we have worked with people with terminal cancer on many occasions, and we're able on many occasions to help those people. So if anybody knows this woman, and I don't know her, and wants to send her an invitation, I'll be happy to meet with her. I'll be back in New York next week and next Thursday, and if she wants to speak with me, I'll be able to put together some protocols and put her in touch with some holistic medical doctors who actually have had very good success with brain cancers, glioblastomas, astrocytomas, etc.
Very good.
All right. Any other questions?
I have one listener that said that I stopped listening to your program on BAI a year ago, and I listen through Progressive Radio Network now. and I also stopped supporting WBAI because after pledging twice, they didn't send me my premiums from over 9 months. Additionally, they don't even apologize for it, and nothing seems to ever change there. When I dropped by your office and explained about the premiums, your employee, Neil, actually gave them to me for free. And I felt bad because I realized that you're giving me books that you had paid for, and yet money was given to BAI. It was essentially their responsibility. And now I understand that they can lose their transmitter unless they raise $200,000 by the end of the month. So my question is, what is the likelihood that that'll happen, that the station will actually go off the air? And he also heard from other, you know, people that are listening to BAI that you haven't been pitching in this fund drive. And I know this is a common thread on the Internet. They're wondering why you haven't been pitching. So I wonder if you want to address that.
I have written to the station manager and to the executive director multiple times, pleading with them to simply honor the audience that gave money to support the station, going clear back more than 6 months. And it has not happened. Now, it could, in their mind, be for completely legitimate reasons. They have more bills than they have cash, and therefore they spend the bills where it's most needed. But there's been this long systemic problem that the audience always comes dead last. And that's fine as long as you're honest about it up front. If you in your pitches, if you say, if you call in today and give us your money for this book or video or whatever it may be, if we decide to get around to it, if we have enough money, we will. But we may not have enough money, and therefore you may get it late or not at all. And don't expect customer service. We don't have it. Don't expect apologies. Not going to happen. Don't expect anyone on the phone. That isn't going to happen. Then a person has a chance to understand what they're dealing with. But in the absence of doing that, every time in the real world, when you offer someone something and you then don't honor it in a timely way, you alienate the audience. And this has been an ongoing problem for decades, not just here, but also in other stations as well. And so I finally had to just draw a line in the sand and say, I cannot go back on the air and ask people to pledge when they have multiple pledges outstanding and you're not making an effort to get them these books and these videos, etc. And when you do, I'll be happy to pledge again. That answers that. To your first question, I believe that it's not realistic that the station will lose its antenna, Bay, because there's a major and very creative fund drive, and I think they're very enthusiastic in how they're going about it. I think they'll easily get the money. But more importantly, the National Foundation will be able to collect the money for a simple reason. The value of BAI, if you exchange BAI signal, let's say you took 99.5 and 50,000 watts, and let's say you exchange that signal for one that's maybe 40,000 watts down the dial and gave BAI $5 to $7 million, that's an enormous financial asset sitting there. So they're not going to allow that asset to be thrown out. So they'll come up with the money. Will that change anything? No. There's going to have to be an entire new mindset at every level in order to help the station and the foundation going forward. I have offered repeatedly ideas, positive ideas of how to help the station and the foundation become more solvent, more professional. Examples were allow the premium creators to do pick, pack, and shipping immediately. So you place an order today, your order goes out tomorrow. That's easily done, and that's done in the real world. PBS does it. Also offer premiums at less price than the 10 to 1. Now if something costs them a dollar, they charge 10. There's no legitimacy to this 10 to 1. Make it more like what people can afford, like 5 to 1, even 4 to 1. So more people can then afford the premiums. Also make the premiums more creative. Don't constantly replay the premiums so you end up with listener fatigue. There are a lot of good things you could do that I hope they do, but have not done up to this point. But they'll get through this. The question is, will they learn any lessons from it and begin to honor the audience first? Because you look at 70% loss of audience per year, and you look at the numbers from Arbitron, then you know why it's taking longer to raise a smaller amount of money. Harvey from Berkeley, your turn, Harvey. And we're on short time here.
Hi, Gary. I just want to, you know, being a doctor, I feel that that hatred is a virus of the mind, and it infects people, and before they know it, they buy guns, and there's hundreds of millions of people been killed by this virus called hatred. And I feel that the cure is appreciation of the gift of the variety of life. Instead of seeing the other as something to kill, it's the gift of variety, because without variety, life would get very boring very fast. I think we need a change of consciousness here so as to reduce our reliance on the military and the guns.
Good statements. I appreciate those. Thanks for contributing that to us today, Harvey.
Thank you, Gary.
Harvey from Berkeley, California. Now let's go to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hello, 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 hello. Today we're taking a look at some of the issues in the news, but I also will be doing a commentary on women's rights through the multifaceted prism of my own experience and the intersection of race, class, culture, and gender.
Wow, okay. If you can fit all that into one show, good for you.
It's all going to fit in one show.
All right. We look forward to it. Utrecht Lead coming right now.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night, just in case you feel you want to hold.